Welcome back, Armand White. It's been a while since we spoke. You know, we've been talking over the last couple of years, really, since your book, Make Spielberg Great Again, came out. We've been kind of going over Spielberg movies and also a few others kind of related films. And we're here talking about a movie that he did, came out 20 years ago, almost exactly 20 years ago, called Minority Report. So welcome back. I'm very excited to talk about this to you, with you, because this is one of those films that you watch and it's, you know, good. And then you give it the passage of time and it takes on a whole new life and significance, not always for the better, not in terms of the quality of the film, but the messages and the kind of presaging of what it was trying to talk about. So how you doing?
Good to see you and talk to you again and to talk about Minority Report, which 20 years later is as timely as ever, if not even more timely, since now we can witness some of the things that Spielberg's movie anticipated with so much dread.
Now, this is, you know, it's based on a Philip K. Dick short story. Have you read it? I've never read it.
I've not read it, no.
Okay.
No, not read it.
And that's, I feel like I should have been able to squeeze that in, or I should have, because watching Spielberg's film, I can't tell how much of this was, you know, it could be credited to him and the screenwriters versus, you know, Mr. Dick, because you're right. There's a lot of stuff in here that has come true. Everything from the version of self-driving cars, you know, science fiction has always kind of been like, oh, one day we'll be flying around in cars. We won't need people. But this specifically reminds me of Teslas. And we've got targeted advertising, people walking through malls and ads speaking directly to them.
Yes.
We've got people walking into a room and saying lights, and then everything just comes on. Everything is automatic. We also have, and this is, you know, post 9/11, there's a zeitgeist of a distrust in government, certainly. But we have this idea of precognition, of being able to bust people for crimes they haven't committed yet, and in detain them indefinitely for crimes that they haven't committed or, you know, will probably never commit. And to a lesser extent, the idea of the military or governmental industrial complex, with this idea of test piloting the pre-crime program in DC and then potentially rolling it out nationwide. So yeah, a lot of scary stuff. Let me start by asking you how you came to this movie, how you experienced it. I assume that you watched it. I know I read your essay from the book that seemed contemporary to the release of the film, but what was your initial reaction to it? Did you have any anticipation going in that you were, you know, going to be interested in the subject, or was it all, you know, kind of a big surprise?
Well, before seeing the film, I think I don't anticipate movies anymore. That doesn't mean I'm not interested in them. I'm always interested in them, but I don't anticipate. I don't even watch trailers if I can help it.
Wow.
Although lately I've been watching them because maybe it's a sign of my lack of interest in what's being put out there. But certainly during the period of Minority Report, that was a period where I refused to watch trailers because I didn't want anything to be spoiled, I guess that's the term. So I would go in and see the film fresh. Minority Report is a film I saw at a press screening in 2002. And I mean, of course, I knew I was going to see a Spielberg film. So I guess in a way there was some expectation, but it was just expectation that it would probably be a film of quality, a film of interest. That's nothing other than that. I'm not a big reader of science fiction literature, so I didn't expect anything in that sense either. I was just expecting a movie. And the surprise of it is the kind of film it was. My first response initially was to the way it looked. That blue tint that prevails throughout the film, connected to the idea of water, the pool where the precogs habitate. And the look of it, I think, was unique then, and I think unmatched since. I think in 2002, it looked like no other movie. And I can't think of another movie since then that has attempted that kind of visual consistency, or even that kind of daring, where the color of the film, the look of the film was consistent throughout, but also unique. I would equate that the blue tint throughout being a kind of replication of vision, such as the Precogs had. So Spielberg and Janusz Kaminski, a cinematographer, decided to give the audiences the same kind of vision as the Precogs, and a vision of the world that John Anderton, played by Tom Cruise, the detective, the Precog detective, would experience.
Now, I will say, I haven't seen it done exactly like this before, but there was a period in the early to mid 2000s. I wonder if it was influenced by the success of Minority Report, but horror films, they really leaned into this kind of desaturated, even, you know, kind of soft color palette I don't even know what to kind of affect, but there was a period where I think by 2007, you know, 5 years after this, I think the Saw films were big into this, and it was just like kind of, hey, you know, I get it aesthetically, but it doesn't really mean anything. Whereas in Minority Report, as you mentioned, there's a lot of symbolism down to I'd forgotten a lot of this movie because I only saw it once 20 years ago in the theater. So rewatching it again last week, I was struck by the DreamWorks logo even has that flurry, that flourish of the rippling water. So we're almost being immersed into this dreamlike state from the get-go, and all the other studio logos come in. And the water theme carries not only to the Precogs, but the whole idea of, you know, Anderson's son at the pool. That was the last memory that he had of him before he was kidnapped. The symbolism is all over this film. And that's one of the things I wanted to kind of kick off with. My surprise, I'm nostalgic for a movie that came out 20 years ago because it's, you know, it is an adaptation of a popular, you know, sci-fi writer, but it's not connected to a property. It's not a sequel. It is its own unique vision. And aside from Denis Villeneuve's Dune last year, I can't remember the time that I saw, or maybe some of the other Villeneuve films over the past few years, this kind of big budget, big screen sci-fi seems to be kind of dead, trampled under the weight of comic book movies.
Well, that's unusual. I would expect, maybe it's my thoughts about comic book movies and science fiction movies, that they're almost the same genre. So I would not have expected that. Perhaps are you saying that what's happened is that comic book movies are not serious the way Minority Report is? Minority Report is not just an action adventure film, as most comic book movies tend to be, but it's a film about serious ideas.
And that's what I'm kind of getting at, this idea of, again, Dune was kind of an exception that came out during, you know, awards season. Minority Report was a giant summer blockbuster with a tremendous amount of brains and even a surprising heart behind it, not to mention the action and the intrigue. The action is so smart. I mean, let me just kind of step aside and say, I have in fact taken a year-long moratorium from watching superhero movies because I think they used to be smart and now they're just kind of getting kind of dumb and everything's oversaturated, which is why watching Minority Report, I forgot. I'm like, yeah, there was a time when mass market big screen entertainment was being sold to people who wanted to really think about what they were watching and not just consume it and pick up on the references from some other TV show they might've seen.
Well, yeah, that's where we are as a culture, isn't it? In the era of content, where everything is content, and the word content doesn't even mean the same anymore, because there's no content, I would wager, in most comic book movies. I'll say it in most Marvel films, in my view. There's just stuff happening in front of you, stuff that you're familiar with and never surprised by. Rather than what we used to think of as content, meaning substantive storytelling, characterizations, recognizable experience, something to think about, something to grasp intellectually, that kind of content. That's what Minority Report represents, because it, as you suggest, it comes from an old era of filmmaking, a period in filmmaking when Spielberg himself, I think, was ideational, where he was interested in exploring ideas as well as genres. So he makes a genre movie, once again, a science fiction film you say Close Encounters and E.T. are also science fiction films. And like them, Minority Report is a science fiction film with substance. And this substance then takes on a kind of has a political aspect to it, of course, and then a prophetic aspect, as it turns out, in the sense of dealing with how society, how mankind functions morally and pursues the idea of right and wrong.
And there's also, you know, I think this film kind of links up to AI, a film that we discussed last year, because that came out in 2001, right? Yeah.
Right.
So we've got back to back these incredible, you know, it's Spielberg's version of a dystopian future, because both of them have these oddly happy endings, which I think you don't get. That's another thing that we don't really have much of now in modern films is hope. Again, I had forgotten a lot about Minority Report. But at the end of the film, you know, we're jumping ahead, I guess, to spoiler territory for anyone who hasn't seen it, but things kind of work out. The good guys win, but there's also still this almost a specter of the greater society hasn't really changed. This one, you know, terrible program has stopped, but there's going to be another one that springs out of it. The same apparatus that will have, you know, cereal boxes that animate and talk to you and sell you their products as you're eating them. They're not going to stop at, you know, one botched program.
Right. It's really remarkable how prescient the film turns out to be. And particularly prescient in the sense of the character of Anderton, how his personal experience affects the way he does his job and awakens him morally. As I think it also, this is a film I would say that also awakened Tom Cruise artistically.
Explain that a bit.
Well, I was not a Tom Cruise fan before Minority Report. And all that changed with Minority Report. I think there is a different kind of emotional concentration in his acting. I mean, he's always been an eager beaver performer. But he's always, which in a way was a little bit off-putting too. It seemed to suggest that he would never grow up. So finally, Spielberg got to work with a Peter Pan actor, but he got an absolute adult performance out of Peter Pan actor. And so remarkably, in Minority Report, Tom Cruise is an adult dealing with the specter of a child's death, Anderson's son's death, his disappearance and death. So you have Tom Cruise all of a sudden playing a recognizable adult, and an adult whose social behavior, whose social commitment is the focus of the film, and something that is believable. He's not just the box office champ entertaining star that he always has been. Suddenly, I felt in Minority Report, he's an actor. Suddenly he played a character that I absolutely found credible, and you know, his performance was moving to me and utterly convincing. You know, there is a theory that, of course, that after so many years doing something, one should get better at it. He got better at it, though I don't separate that from his good fortune in working with Spielberg, a good fortune that was mutual for both of them, at least in two films, Cruise's performance in Minority Report and in War of the World, I think, are the best performances of his career. And in each one, he plays adults, plays fathers, and who are emotionally strained and forced to act morally. And to make moral choices, and moral choices is of course the whole point of the story of Minority Report. As Agatha tells him, you must choose. And the idea of a moral choice is certainly pertinent to what we face in the world today. And the technology, the advanced technology that we see in the futuristic story of Minority Report is kind of all inspiring and impressive. But the idea of moral choice is stunning, because we're forced to deal with it, we're forced to take it seriously, we're forced to contemplate what moral choice, what choice requires and what it entails.
Yeah, I mean, that's for anyone who hasn't seen the movie, he is, Cruise plays Anderton, the kind of the head of the pre-crime unit. Basically, it's a convoluted series where these wooden balls are carved and drawn and spit out of a machine to indicate who is going to be the victim of a crime and who's going to commit the crime. They have a special task force that goes out and tries to prevent that event from happening. And, you know, as we learn, there hasn't been a murder, specifically a crimes of passion, murder. There hasn't been a murder, I think, in the 6 years or 9 years, whatever, since the program had started. So there's a big push to take it national. He ends up being framed for the murder of a guy named Leo Crow, a person that his character has never met. So he ends up kidnapping one of three precogs, as they're called. They're sort of mutant children, you know, young, not young adults, but young adults who share a psychic connection and who spit out these premonitions for the feds to pursue. So it's a person on the run movie. It's a search for identity film. But you're right, it also is a great moral question. It also brings into question ideas of fate, because Anderton figures, well, if I don't know this person that I'm supposed to kill, yet I've seen this vision, I just have to stay away from that place and never meet this person. And it doesn't end up being as simple as that, especially because the person that he ends up murdering, or in the premonition at least, is the person who kidnapped his son. He comes to find out in the room in that moment. And when that information is revealed, he has the choice, as Agatha the precog mentions, that he doesn't have to pull the trigger. Well, he doesn't, but someone else assassinates that guy. So there is a murder that happens, and it can be set up to look like John Anderton did it. So the premonition came true. Just, it's this whole idea of fate. You can't escape it, even if you don't understand it in the moment. I think that's kind of a delicious idea to ponder. And again, not the kind of thing that you're going to find, you know, in Avengers 4.
Sure. Excellent synopsis. And that's what happens for sure. And Spielberg makes all aspects Anderson is part of the futuristic vision that we see in the film. But who Anderton is as a person, as a member of society, but also as a suffering person, a person who has to work through the pain that he's feeling since his bereavement, as well as the collapse of his marriage. And how Anderton works through that while also performing his duty as an officer of the law makes it a very, very rich characterization. And the characterization that, as in the best movies, that we respond to. And what I mean by that is, I think it'd be a great thing if 20 years later people return to Minority Report and get the necessary understanding that one reason that we pay any attention at all to works of art is so that we can see ourselves in other characters and in other people and understand how other people are like us. I think this is the purpose of art. It's how drama functions, it's why drama matters. And I think that's been ignored, according to contemporary camp. And people say they want to see themselves represented, rather than understanding that, you know, if you open your eyes and your mind, you are being represented when there is a story and a characterization that is honest, that's inquiring, that relates to human behavior in an interesting way.
Yeah, and it is sort of a universal specific in that it poses that question, you know, one of many questions, but one of them would be, you know, if someone if you got in the same room as someone who did something terrible to a loved one, what would you really do to them? Could you pull that trigger? You know, metaphorically, of course. And you know, the movie has its own answers, but you really have to think about it. You know, people say, oh, if I ever got my hands on so-and-so, is that truly the case? Because you've got, you know, Anderton wasn't just, you know, a bureaucrat who ended up in this position. He was a former, I think, Baltimore cop before he signed on to this unit. So he'd seen some, you know, pretty terrible things in his career. So he is by all, you know, definitions, a tough guy. I think in a lesser movie, he would have just dealt out the justice, such as it, you know, so-called justice. And we would have been left with, yeah, the kind of, ooh, I'm glad that guy bought it. But this Leo Crow character is such a, you know, he is undeniably a monster because we see the evidence planted as it was, but evidence of his previous, you know, crime of, you know, kidnapping and doing awful things to children. But you also understand the sort of weird injustice of how he's been manipulated by the system, set up as a fall guy for something that he, you know, didn't honestly do. Now, of course, he mentioned that he has a family that is going to be taken care of if he, you know, gets Epstein, another kind of bit of precognition on the part of Spielberg and company. But it's not as black and white, because he doesn't come off as a monster. He's just an extremely troubled human being, I think.
Sure. Yeah. Pathetic character. And also, you know, pathetic in a similar way to the Tom Bosley character in the night gallery sequence that Spielberg directed early for television early in his career, that night gallery episode with Joan Crawford.
I didn't see it.
Oh, it's worth seeing for sure, obviously, and it relates to Minority Report. If I can recall, I actually haven't seen it since I first saw it, but if I can recall parts of the plot, Joan Crawford plays a rich woman who's losing her eyesight, and so she decides to buy the eyes of a poor man like Leo Crow, a man in need of money. And so she purchases the eyes of the figure played by Tom Bosley. Tom Bosley, some people might remember as the father in the TV series Happy Days. And this is before Happy Days, though, when Tom Bosley had a serious reputation in pop culture, especially from Broadway. But anyway, Joan Crawford buys his eyes, and there's a segment of the story in that Night Gallery episode that's rather moving. Because it starts to detail why the Tom Bosley character agrees to sell his eyes, to sell him. And he sells his eyes because he needs the money, because he's desperate. Joan Crawford then gets his eyes, and as they say, things happen. but it's like a kind of precognition of one of the dilemmas in Minority Report that Spielberg returns to decades later. The ideas of eyeball replacement surgery started in Night Gallery, and here it is again in Minority Report, but much more seriously this time. Although the Night Gallery episode is a commendable and serious piece of storytelling, actually. But those ideas, that situation is expanded in Minority Report. And it's very interesting to see how Spielberg expands that, those details of incidents, and how his own artistry has, of course, been enhanced over that period of time, over those decades. He's not just a clever television director at the time Minority Report, he was a great filmmaker. And I like to say also, one of the things that is fascinating about Minority Report is that it's a film about vision. Hence its style, its blue water tinted, vision tinted visual style. And also throughout the film, Spielberg makes reference to how we see things, how vision operates, how vision affects the way we think. And so many details, so many symbols, as you say, are extraordinary. One of the first that I think of is when the first crime is committed, when the precogs predict a crime happening, So Anderton must then intervene to stop the crime from happening. It takes place in a home in Washington, D.C., where a man discovers that his wife is being unfaithful. And the setup to that is that we see the man, the wife, and their school child at breakfast. And the school child is rehearsing a school presentation on Abraham Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address. And we see him cutting out a photograph, a picture of Lincoln. And then a very strange image, symbolic image occurs. The kid takes a pair of scissors and he starts to cut out Abraham Lincoln's eyes. And fascinating image because it's a violent image because there you see the point of the scissor blades piercing eyeballs. And this is not accidental. This is consistent with the idea of with the symbolism throughout the film. We also hear the school kid rehearsing the Gettysburg Address, and which is a moral declaration about the state of the nation during the Civil War, but of course, especially even today, where we're going through a kind of moral Civil War that makes it relevant today. But there was purpose and point to it in 2002 as well, because that's what the film is really about. There's a story in Minority Report, but it's really about moral choice. And the symbols throughout the film, the symbols throughout the film reinforce that, reinforce how moral choice often depends on how we see things, the way we see things, and makes us think about it. And the way we see things is, of course, is as I said before, beautifully performed by Tom Cruise when he comes to that crucial moment where he has to make a moral choice. But before he makes the moral choice, he has a realization about, as you said, about his fate, but also about his feelings. And he makes his own kind of personal moral declaration at that moment. A moment of realization about what he is capable of, and that leads to a moment in the film that is one, I think, one of the most powerful and moving moments in all the Spielberg movies. Not to be given away here, because people deserve the pleasure of discovering it themselves.
Very good. I want to talk about this idea of, you know, getting back to the visuals. There was a sequence that reminded me of Will Eisner's old Spirit comics from, you know, forever ago. He was a very influential artist and writer on the comics medium. And he would very often get very creative with his, you know, sort of camera angles on the comics page and weave in and around. He would turn lettering into architecture and vice versa. The scene where Anderton is hiding out in this kind of a tenement building because he's gone to a black market surgeon to have his eyes removed so that he can get into the, you know, the headquarters of pre-crime undetected. He gets the procedure done. He's got these, you know, gauze bandages wrapped around his head with strict instructions not to remove them for 12 hours and don't itch them because it'll mess up his eyesight forever. Of course, right during this time, the pre-crime cops get a tip and they go in and they're searching the building. They have these little mechanical spiders. They go all throughout the building into every unit and they crawl up on everybody who's inside and they examine their eyes. They shoot little lasers into their eyes to read who they are, to report back to headquarters so they can say, oh, this is not the person we're looking for. What's stunning to me, aside from the fact that in addition to watching the spiders move, you know, they're all CGI spiders, but they move in a very spider-like manner, is the way that the camera crawls around this tenement building, going in and out of windows and around corners and kind of upside down. It looks like we're almost watching a spider's POV of that sequence. What is shocking to me, and maybe it shouldn't be considering the way things have gone in the last couple of years, is how, you know, it's only been 6 years since this pre-crime thing has been, you know, made national news. And I guess since the orders came down from the department or whatever, that all the residents of DC ostensibly need to submit to these, I guess, warrantless searches of their eyeballs, but people stop what they're doing so these little spiders can just crawl up, and you know, there's no one who really resists them, possibly because they know better. But there's a scene where a couple is fighting, you know, having a terrible argument in their kitchen. And all of a sudden they see the spiders crawl in, they stop and they just kind of like hold in place. The spiders crawl up, examine them, then they go away and they just resume fighting as if it's the most natural thing in the world. And that was, I hadn't picked up on that in 2002, but I think that's because that particular moment has, you know, more resonance right now.
Sure. Yeah, it's a great call. It's a, it's kind of a prevision of submission and obedience, which has come true.
Yeah.
And people who say that they believe in bodily autonomy don't when the government demands it anymore. So yeah, that's it's very insightful. Very insightful about the dangers of governmental overreach. And also about the dangers of people willingly submitting their own rights to the government. Seeing plays that out without making a point beyond that. That's enough of a point. If we understand anything about human behavior, about our own behavior, when we see the incident that you speak of, we have to put ourselves in those place, in the place of those characters as well. That sequence is terrifying, you know, I think in a way that the rest of the film is not, because it really is about the encroachment of government on privacy. And I remember when I first saw that scene, my first response to it was that this was a De Palma moment for Spielberg. Because it's largely overhead camera angles, such as De Palma frequently uses, and it's also in itself a kind of mini voyeuristic adventure, an adventure about voyeurism, which is a persistent De Palma theme, where we are looking in, peeking in into privacy that we probably should not, and then we see things that we wish we hadn't seen. And what we see in that sequence of Minority Report is the complete submission of society, of the populace, to a government that doesn't really know what it's doing, although it thinks it's doing the right thing. I'm not sure in terms of what the book makes Spielberg great again, that Spielberg was necessarily conscious of what he was digging into and stirring up with his story. But he gets credit for it. As a perceptive artist, as an artist who understands something about how government operates and also how human beings how human beings behave when they submit themselves.
There's one thing I do want to talk about as well is Colin Farrell, who shows up as a Fed, and he's kind of the red herring painted almost as the villain throughout the piece, even though he's, you know, he's an Irish Catholic who's constantly kissing his cross. So I guess it's sort of a stereotypical bit, but this really is a star-making performance, I think, for him. He's so great in this film. I think the one criticism I had when I first saw it was his arc, you know, with, you know, Max von Sydow. And I think you're right. There's some things we should leave spoiler free for those who haven't seen Minority Report. There is... You saw L.A. Confidential, right?
Yes.
Yeah. There's the Kevin Spacey, James Cromwell dynamic plays out 5 years later again in Minority Report. And I felt that was a little bit too familiar for my taste. Now, I don't know which, it's a chicken and the egg thing. Maybe this was written before that novel and that movie came out, but it was just a bit too, I felt like I'd seen this too recently to be really affected by it. But watching it 20 years later, their climactic scene together was truly heartbreaking.
Okay. Yes. Not,
speaking of someone who has a heart. No.
You speak for the heart community.
Yes. I identify as having a heart. Yes.
My initial response to that is, well, it's the difference between an artist and some and a filmmaker who isn't an artist, merely a storyteller. There is that difference. I don't recall feeling anything while watching L.A. Confidential. And not because I'm heartless, but because the film wasn't done in a way that would elicit much feeling from me. I was just watching a spectacle of sorts, rather than a moral drama.
Well, I think that's the surprising thing about Minority Report is it is such a, you know, we've kind of talked about this already, but it's got the sci-fi spectacle, but also has, you know, a tremendous dramatic heft. I'm with you. I think this is one of Tom Cruise's best performances, and I kind of wish he would have steered more into this rather than going on and making, you know, more Mission Impossible sequels and a Top Gun sequel. I mean, I like Top Gun Maverick. I think it's a fine entertainment, but given the choice between that and having him really go down the path of being a quote unquote big serious actor based on the strength of what he did in Minority Report, there's no contest. Like the scene at the pool, when he gets, you know, he realizes that his son is missing and he's looking around in that kind of heart pounding confusion. And then later the sense of loss when he's on this, you know, street drug called Narrowin, watching old, you know, video files of his son and repeating them back verbatim because he's gotten to this like really unhealthy dark spiral of just consuming this over and over again to the point where he feels like he's talking to his son. You know, that's I think the centerpiece of the movie. The flying cars and the crazy buildings and the talking ads and stuff, that's window dressing to something I think is it's the unsold hero of this movie, which is Cruise's performance.
Sure. Well, yes. So I agree with you about Colin Farrell. He's a good actor and say star making, but you know, he can't match the wattage of Tom Cruise's stardom, frankly. I mean, the film's designed that way also. And of course, Farrell is terrific in the film. Tom is more than terrific. And wouldn't it have been wonderful, if we can indulge in a little speculation now, wouldn't it have been wonderful if apparently there had not been some kind of disconnection between Spielberg and Cruise, and they have made more films together, rather than Spielberg making a series of films with his it seems to be his preferred protagonist Tom Hanks, because I think it's fair to say to mention how I think as Tom Cruise has conducted his own career post the Spielberg movies, post Minority Report, I think he's been trying to replicate that kind of substantive action movie all along. I think it was always his interest, even when the films were superficial, like the Top Gun movies. I think he was always interested in a certain kind of action vehicle, as in Mission Impossible, the first Mission Impossible, the De Palma Mission Impossible, and then the kinds of films he began to produce himself. After his relationship with Spielberg fell apart. I can imagine that, you know, given the emotional portrayal that Spielberg gets from Tom Cruise in Minority Report and in War of the Worlds, there might have been more interesting things they could have done together. Cruise being a different kind of dramatic actor from Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks seems to always play a kind of paragon in most of his movies, and especially in his Spielberg movies, to the point that it becomes a bore, frankly. Whereas Tom Cruise always wants to act; he always wants to be the center of an emotional drama, and that's certainly much more interesting to look at, to watch, than a paragon, is someone who's always right, who represents a kind of idealization of America rather than an idea of American character that we must ponder and see ourselves in, and perhaps question, but then also see an American go through events and feelings, a good man, once again, a moral choice.
Well, this, yeah, 2002, we're like 3 years post Matrix. And, you know, I don't think the Matrix holds up that well. I think it was one of those movies that was really great and important for its time. But I think Minority Report, after watching it a second time, is sort of what the Matrix wanted to be, not in terms of just in terms of technology and what you can do, but in terms of the ideas and the evolution of the protagonist. When we first meet Anderton, who I think in your essay in the book Makes Spielberg Great Again, you draw the connection of Anderton is an odd name. It's almost like the mixture of Anderson and automaton. which when we first see Anderton in the film, he's going through that pre-crime investigation in the lab with the very kind of Iron Man Tony Stark thing of being able to move kind of holograms around with his fingers. But as he's suiting up, he takes that sort of in the 3D animator's pose, like the stock position of a 3D model, where it's sort of like the almost like a Michelangelo cruciform figure. And then he is brought to life. He's switched on. And then he kind of goes about his business of being very mechanical in reporting what he's seeing, putting the pieces together. So he's almost like a human machine. He's waking up throughout the course of the film, again, back to that eyes and dreamlike imagery, to become a fully realized person who ends up bucking the system and bringing it all down to make a better world for at least himself and his you know, ex-wife. There's far more going that than Neo captured in, you know, Keanu Reeves in 4 Matrix movies. Tom Cruise did it in 1.
Sure. Well, okay. Yeah. So once again, we have the example of Spielberg compared to a less gifted film, the Wachowskis and the LA Confidential guy, Curtis Hanson. Spielberg works on a different level. When Spielberg was good, when he was great, he worked on a different level than those filmmakers, which I would go so far as to say Wachowskis and Curtis Hanson were more adolescent. Not the visions in The Matrix and in LA Confidential are the kinds of things that the adolescents, an adolescent view of the world in both movies, or an adolescent view of circumstance in both movies, whereas Spielberg gets profound. And the profundity is not just the idea about government and human responsibility, but also profoundly personal. You mentioned how moving it is when Anderton is looking at the video clips of his dead child. Kind of heartbreaking in a way.
But even so you do have a heart then.
yes, of course. I'm part of that community. But
well, it's you know,
in New York, some people always talk about being part of the community. I am part of the movie watching community with a heart. But I also wanted to get to that the moment in Minority Report that is, I think, so extraordinary. When Anderton thinks back to the last moments that he saw his child, his son, and it takes place at a public pool, and where he dives under the water to test how long he can hold his breath. You know, it was one of the games he plays with his child about his son, about how long you can hold your breath, how long you can sustain yourself and still maintain stamina. So Tom Cruise, Anderton, dunks into the pool for a moment. And while he's underwater, he opens his eyes underwater and he's surrounded by happy children. And I think this is one of the great moments in Spielberg. Because it's a moment of happiness. It's a moment of a sense of family and fatherhood for an instant. But at the same time, the story has been established that we know that this is going to be brief, and that when he emerges from the water, that that brief moment of bliss will be destroyed. So that the moment that he is underwater and he's surrounded by happy children is not a trite moment of Spielberg goodness, though it's full of goodness. But the goodness, we understand the goodness in a deeper sense, in a fuller sense, which makes it moving, which makes it heartbreaking, ultimately heartbreaking. It's great. It's an absolutely profound moment, I think. And of course, being a more consistent filmmaker than the Wachowskis and Curtis Hanson, that moment of being surrounded by images of children has a parallel later in the story when Anderton encounters Leo Crow. He's surrounded by images of children in an entirely different scenes.
Well, and also that encounter later on invites a reinterpretation of that pool scene and getting back to eyes and watching, because I think Leo was talking about how he was watching Sean, the young boy, at the pool, and that's how he knew, like, he was following them. That's how he knew precisely when to go snatch him up, because Cruz is under the water, but he's not under the water that long,
right?
You know, and when he comes up, his son is just gone, which means Leo had time to pick the kid up and move very quickly yet inconspicuously through this crowded pool, because when Anderton comes up and he's looking for his son, there aren't a lot of people pointing and saying, oh yeah, there's a guy who just stole a kid, which means that kidnapping was, you know, very, very casual in a sense, you know? What I'm saying is that moment when you're thinking about Cruz under the pool or Anderton and what he's seeing, you also have to step back and think about what Leo Crow was seeing, what he was doing with what he saw in those moments going on above the surface. It's kind of horrific and heartbreaking as well.
Yes. Spielberg complicates the moment. It's not just a moment of happiness, of bliss. It's quite complicated. And any filmmaker who can do that, who can get complication of bliss and tragedy happening at once. This is the kind of thing that makes movies sometimes overwhelming, and why you go back, because you don't get that kind of clarity, that clarity about life and possibilities in life. You don't get it in regular movies. You only get it in great ones.
Now, I do want to pull over and talk a bit about Samantha Morton, who plays Agatha in the film. She's not in the movie very much in a significant way. She spends a lot of time in that pool, and then when she's out, she's sort of on the run with Tom Cruise. But there is a scene at Tom's ex-wife's house when she kind of opens up and goes through her visions of what, I guess, the alternate life that she saw for her son, for the Anderson's son. That's a weepy moment, because it's almost like wish fulfillment on the part of the family. But you also realize that it's something that they can never experience.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe we need a tote card to list the great moments in Minority Report. because there are so many of them, and that's one of them. Agatha's vision of the Anderson child and what his future would have been is, I think, that's also one of the kinds of moments that people go to movies for, whether they know it or not. Who knows in watching the story that something like that is going to occur, but when it occurs, the feelings that it provokes in you are extraordinary. And I think moviegoers want more of that. They want more of that rather than monsters who morph into war machines or whatever. That's the kind of thing that makes movies a compelling and addictive experience. And Spielberg's capable of that. So many good moments in the Samantha Morton Agatha character. Not just that one towards the end, but But also that remarkable, another remarkable, meaningful, symbolic image that Spielberg comes up with, where she and Anderton are momentarily embracing, and their heads are together. And their heads are together in a way like a kind of Janus figure, one facing right, one facing left. Just all of a sudden, there's a kind of a visual ideal of different life paths that two people can share at one moment. That's great filmmaking. I always think that that every image in a movie has to carry an idea, at least one idea, and that's why images in movies are so fascinating. And because you not just see the characters on screen or a situation or a place on screen, but that image suggests things to us. That image contains ideas that are amazing because we have to think about them, because we want to think about them, because it's such an extraordinary image that we want to hold on to it and ponder it more.
You know, my stomach's starting to turn a little bit because I'm thinking about Jurassic World Dominion, which is, you know, the bastard great grandchild of Steven Spielberg's marvelous Jurassic Park. And I sat through all 2.5 hours of that movie with glazed over eyes. It's full of so-called action sequences, but they signify nothing and they're not imaginative. There's a great extended scene involving jetpacks in this movie, which even for 20-year-old, you know, CGI and green screen holds up remarkably well. But there's a bit where Anderton is on the run from the cops. They all have jetpacks. He ends up latching onto one of them and they fly into an apartment and there's a family screaming at them, like, get the hell out of here. And one of them, I think, is cooking hamburgers on the grill and the jetpack, as they're hovering over it, charbroils the hamburgers. It's just such a wacky moment, but it's just an idea. I get the feeling, like, I don't know if that was in the script. I feel like they were shooting that, or there was some kind of on the set moment where, like, hey, we got these hamburgers. Would it be funny if, instead of building, you know, some stupid gag about a velociraptor? I don't know. I don't know what's gone on with the legacy of Spielberg in terms of the movies that he has wrought based on the properties that he's, you know, kind of overseen. But yeah, the magic is just completely zapped out at this point.
Well, that's part of the reason for Make Spielberg Great Again, to try to contemplate what's happened to him as well as what's happened to the culture. It's happened to criticism in the time that his career has taken place. And that's you point out one of the things that used to be great about Spielberg. If I may, that scene reminds me of a moment in grad school where I had the good fortune to have as a screenwriting professor, Samson Raphaelson. Samson Raphaelson was arguably the best screenwriter in America that the director Ernst Lubitsch worked with. They're best known for Trouble in Paradise and Shop Around the Corner. Samson Raphaelson also wrote Hitchcock's Suspicion. He was a great, great screenwriter. And I had the good fortune of having him as a professor when I was in grad school at Columbia. And I remember one point we saw and discussed the movie It Happened One Night. And this is early in the semester. And so I said to Mr. Raphaelson, because he had, in the discussion, he'd started to rail against It Happened One Night. And I said, Mr. Raphaelson, I said, you seem bitter about this film. Why are you complaining about a film which has pleased people over the years, which won a number of Academy Awards, which is a good film? I said, maybe not a great film, but it's a good film. I said, why are you nitpicking at it? And Mr. Raphaelson said, yes, it's a very professional film, but is that the best they could do? And this is one of the key moments of my education, frankly, certainly of my aesthetic education. He said, is that the best they can do? And when Spielberg has the jetpacks grill the hamburgers, that's the best you can do. It's not just a piece of functional filmmaking. We need the jetpacks to go through this tenement, because we need something that's really exciting. And a great filmmaker operating at his peak, at his best, decides, well, the action itself isn't enough. We need something more. We need some way to portray character. We need some way to a different aspect of that circumstance that's going to make the audience think more, feel more, and possibly entertain them more. It's the best. When Spielberg was great, he's an example of a filmmaker doing his best rather than doing something that just gets by. Not just action, but action plus something more. That's the sign of a great filmmaker, as Mr. Ravelson knew.
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself, and I didn't say it, neither did you. You're quoting your professor, but I think he was spot on. Not to derail too much, but you know, I was watching that Star Wars Obi-Wan Kenobi show. And I got into a bit of a dust up with some of my colleagues about why was I nitpicking and complaining and tearing the show apart so much. And it was essentially boiled that down to that. Now, I'm a child of Star Wars, so I take the legacy of Star Wars very kind of seriously. And when I look at this new stuff they're putting out, I ask, really, is this the best you can do? And the answer is not by a country mile. Right. That's why I think Minority Report stands out above a lot of other summer blockbusters. I still can't believe this was a summer blockbuster movie, one of the highest grossing films of 2002, it turned out.
Yeah, well, deservedly so. And when a filmmaker works that way, it's in a sense, it's what especially a truly popular artist like Spielberg, it's kind of what he owes the audience, what he owes the public, giving the public your best, not just something that gets by, not something, and never fossil, never something they've already seen. You're the best. Give them something more, and always something they can think about and something they can marvel over as well. Images that inspire Marvel.
But not necessarily Marvel movies.
No. Almost never Marvel movies. And so another aspect of Minority Report that we didn't touch on is how also when Spielberg was great, he comes from that era of 70s American Renaissance filmmakers. Who were responding to Hollywood history as well as the influence of European art cinema. And so they would often make reference to the movie past and to different genres. And Minority Report is one of the pleasures of Minority Report is seeing the many different genres that Spielberg references, but always, as they say, always servicing the story. But very often dipping into different genres and elevating them and making them a part of the tale that's being told in Minority Report. An example of that is what I think of as a kind of a Wizard of Oz sequence where he goes to meet the wizard. He goes to meet the woman who invented precogs, played by the actress Lois Smith. And this is a segment of the film that I think very intentionally references Wizard of Oz as the eyeball operation sequence. It only references the kind of Sam Fuller noir with a sense of humor about it as well. When Spielberg dips into these different genres, it's a way of expanding the story, of expanding the filmmaking and film knowledge experience, which is what the great American filmmakers of the 1970s frequently did. And he continued that pursuit, I think, in 2002 with Minority Report. It's a remarkable moment where Anderton enters that kind of blue, green, lilac greenhouse setting. And he meets the woman who invented the precogs. And it's not just an adventure into a kind of Oz-like territory, but it brings out one of the tragic subcurrents in the film, which is who the precogs are and how they came about. They're social tragedy. They're all children who were whose conditions result from drugs, from the way drugs have infected society that they were born into. A very serious idea that we can contemplate while enjoying the story of An Early Report. Different levels, different layers of meaning and effect that Spielberg is able to achieve while telling the story.
Well, yeah, the Wizard of Oz analogy is perfect, I think, because during that story, the whole idea is to try and get to the Emerald City to get home, and that's where they ultimately discover the truth of their situation. Mm-hmm. In this, Anderton's going to a greenhouse at Emerald City all of its own, where he learns about, you know, the truth of the situation and how he's going to be able to get himself not home, but hopefully, you know, cleared of this this horrible wrongdoing. It also reminds me of, and I haven't seen War of the Worlds in a long time, but this scene stands out as a break from everything that's going on. It sort of reminds me of the scene where Tom Cruise's character runs into Tim Robbins' character, sort of in the middle of War of the Worlds. It's a very different kind of intensity, but it's still there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's Tim Robbins, the vigilante of the piece, of War of the Worlds. Yeah, you know, so I mean, a great narrator can do those kinds of shifts in tone, and still effectively stick to the main idea of the story.
Yeah. So, well, there's tons of layers that are on display in Minority Report. So if anyone watching this has not seen it, hopefully we haven't spoiled it too much, but it's definitely a film worth checking out, watching on a big screen, I think. It'd be wonderful to see this thing re-released somehow, because I would definitely go check it out in a theater. But Armand, thank you again for hanging out and talking about another great Spielberg movie. And where can folks find you?
Well, I'm still writing at National Review. Happy to be there, and that's a perch. So I'm still taking assessment of the things that go on in cinema and in music as well. So National Review and Nick Spielberg Great Again and Kicking the Sea.
Cool, man. Well, yeah, and folks should definitely check out Make Spielberg Great Again. You can find it on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold. If this conversation has given you any kind of a clue, the book is full of essays, a complete retrospective of Spielberg's career up until the point it was, you know, written. And you know, lots of informative, deep thinking, and very entertaining and insightful essays by Mr. White. So thank you again, sir. We'll talk about something else coming up. I don't know exactly what that'll be, but we'll think of something. I appreciate you coming back on, man.
Me too. I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Ian.
All right. Take it easy.